Welcome to Yada Yada Radio and to the Shabbat evening study. I'm Yada. My pleasure to welcome Larry and James into the program. How are you guys?
Doing good.
Everything's good, you know. I've got the two-headed god Janus here on my side.
Both coming and going, huh?
Yeah, a coming and a going. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you just don't know if you're riding away from them or riding towards them.
I would ask you, in the world of Christianity, when does the new year start?
I have no idea. I do know that we had a fellow that posted on his wall that there were people actually trying to debate what God's New Year's resolution is.
Wow. Yeah, you know, well, the fact is that the Christians do have a new year, and it is January 1st. It is based upon Janus, which is the door and being the portal to new beginnings and Roman pagan mythology. And that new year was established as the new year day, as the beginning of the year, by the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, there really is no distinction between Roman Catholicism and Imperial Rome. Imperial Rome, under Theodosius, became the Roman Catholic Church. They became inseparable, and so they simply designated their year using not only the pagan names for months and naming 2 months after men who claimed to be God, Augustus, August, and Julius, July. The Christian year starts January 1st. It is actually now a Christian holiday because of the Roman Catholic Church. You know, but asking what resolutions God would make at the beginning of the new year is to be completely, totally, and wholly oblivious.
They've done it, haven't they? They crossed the line.
Yeah,
they went full retard on that.
What would Christ want as a gift for Christmas? And you're saying, say what?
Come on. New Year's resolution. The New Year's resolution is all about change. It's something I want to change about myself. Or, you know, Yah says he doesn't change, so he can't have a New Year's resolution.
No.
Even if it was a proper New Year.
Yeah, he does have a, he is resolved to celebrate something during the first month of the year, but that happens to be Abib, and it's the 14th day of that month, which is Passover, followed by Matzah and Bukurim, and he's devoted every year, resolved to invite us to attend a party with him. It's just a crying shame that so few people do it.
Well, you know, you take this god Janus,
yes,
and you remove the J, and you get a good look at who he really is. That's all.
And speaking of coming and going, huh?
There you go.
All right. Well, with that that lovely thought in mind, I do want to return back to the 119th Psalm. We had devoted an enormous amount of the program to the verb tenses and moods, and particularly the moods, and Psalm 119, 153. I want to return there and pick up back where we were, and we're going to come upon a mention of Chanan, mercy, and then, James, you sent me an email that will tie in nicely with what we can learn about the difference between Chanan, mercy, and the Charis Christian concept of grace. So, if you don't mind, it begins with the following words. You want to see my response and my diligence, my willingness to answer the call and actively engage. So, you have chosen to prepare me so that I'm ready to be saved and withdrawn, because indeed, I have not ignored, nor have I overlooked, nor lost sight of, nor responded inappropriately to your Torah. What we determined in the last program, actually it was two programs ago, was that the imperative mood, and this was the ra'ah, you want to see, in the imperative mood, it expresses a second person volition, a desire, a will, a choice, a decision, a proclivity for something in the second person. So since this is a song where the lyrics are written by Dodd to Yahweh, who is second person? Sure as heck ain't Dodd, right?
No, it's Yahweh.
It's Yahweh. That's the, and the imperative only expresses second person volition. So, you know, I had to change these translations when I went through them to in recognition that I had correctly conveyed the imperative mood as an expression of volition, but I didn't really think it all the way through and to think, all right, it's a second, I mean, my grammatical skills are not very good. And I didn't think it through. Okay, it's a second-person expression of volition, but this is Dodd speaking in first person to Yahweh, who becomes the second person. This has to be written that Yahweh wants to see. Yahweh desires.
What number are we on? I'm sorry. Yeah,
we're on Psalm 119, 153.
153. Okay.
Yep, 153. So you want to see. And when it's changed to the second-person volition, it's almost incomparable to it without the expression of volition or desire, and it's almost incomparable to the same thing written in first person volition, because this is not I want to see, or I want
you,
you want to see. Or, yeah, like I want you to see my response and my willingness. It is you want to see. And when you correctly convey the imperative mood, and that's really the benefit of being observant, is because if you're really observant, if you're closely examining and carefully considering Yahweh's testimony, and this is the most important psalm relative to Yahweh's testimony because it tells us how to observe the Torah, when you are extraordinarily careful in your examination and consideration of these words, one of the things you're going to learn is that this is an expression of second-person volition. And then once you do that, you understand who Yahweh is, what he wants, why he created the universe, why the covenant exists, why the Torah was written. I mean, just this simple a statement as you want to see my response and my diligence, my willingness to answer the call and actively engage, it answers every one of those questions. Who Yahweh is, what he wants, what his character is like, why the universe exists, why he authored his Torah. All of that is answered in that simple expression. Yahweh gave us the Torah. He offered the covenant. He created the universe. He conceived life for the express purpose that he wants to see. He wants to notice our response and diligence, our willingness to answer the call and to engage. Answer the call? What call? Does he call us to anything in particular? He calls us to the Torah.
Yeah.
What else does he call us to?
Yeah.
Well, he calls us to the called out assembly meetings.
That is correct. So the Moed Mikra, he actually invites us. They're called out, and he's calling to us, inviting to us to attend. And so you want to see our willingness to answer that call. He wants to see our willingness to answer his invitation to meet with him. Now, you would think that everyone on the planet would respond to the Creator's invitation to meet with him. But, you know, there's one in a million of us that do. Now, the second is, you want to see me actively engaged. What is it that Yahweh wants us to engage in?
The relationship. He wants us to engage in observing the Torah, and by doing so, we're learning a lot about Yahweh.
And we'll actively engage in the covenant. That's the relationship. So this explains that Yahweh wants to see us respond to his invitations, and he wants to see us engage in the covenant. So, you have chosen to prepare me so that I'm ready to be saved and withdrawn. Well, what do the Moed Mikra do for us?
Well, they
bring us into the family.
Eternity.
They prepare us to be saved, right? Can God save somebody that's mortal? Or does he have to make us immortal? Can God save somebody that's imperfect?
No,
they've got to be made perfect. And so the Moed Mikre, including Bukurim, which is firstborn children, our adoption, and also Shavuah, where we're enriched with his teaching and empowered by his spirit, all four of those are required to prepare us to be saved and withdrawn. We're not prepared to be saved and withdrawn until we answer the call, attend to those meetings, and when we answer the call and attend those meetings with the right mindset, we are prepared to be withdrawn. However, the only ones who benefit from those meetings are those who have actively engaged in the covenant.
Yeah, they've shared it. They've allowed it to grow. They've kept his words alive. They kept his
So you see that the transition here? God is saying, you want to see my diligence and my response, my willingness to answer the call and engage, so you have chosen to prepare me, so I'm ready to be saved and withdrawn. These things flow. They're not separate thoughts. One flows out of the other. God is telling us how we are prepared to be prepared to be saved and withdrawn from this world. Respond to him.
You know,
answer
you notice
call,
those are all very active words that that he's using. You know, these are all active things God wants us doing. It isn't the passive sit back faith. It is actively engaging. It is a very active relationship.
Correct. Absolutely true. There are things you have to do to be prepared to be saved.
Exactly.
And being saved, this is actually in the right order. To be saved, you first have to do your, you know, in business we call it due diligence. That means that you study the documents, you study the opportunity, you study the relationship, you study the business agreement before you sign it. And you study about who you're going to do business with. You learn as much as you can about the other party if you're going to engage in business. It's called due diligence. Well, in Yahweh's, where would you do your due diligence?
In the Torah. That's
right.
That's the only place to do it.
Right. You read the Torah and you respond. And when you read the Torah, you do your due diligence, you're going to find that the heart of the Torah is the covenant, and the covenant is empowered. Its benefits are enabled by the first four of the Moed Mikre. And when you answer the call, attend the Moed Mikre after having engaged in the covenant relationship, we are prepared to be saved and withdrawn. There's a reason that this statement is 153 out of 176. Doe didn't start here. This is where you come once you've done your due diligence. This is the summation of everything he's been sharing with us. This is where the Torah leads. And you'll also notice here, too, that salvation is the third thing on the list. Right? I mean, don't Christians just focus on salvation through faith in the gospel
grace.
Of faith?
Yeah.
They don't
the
focus
first question
on,
you ever get asked by a Christian is, are you saved?
Yeah, and what I would say is, and I would respond to say, do you know who God is? Do you know his name? Do you know anything about him? Who saved
you? Do you know his character?
Right. Do you have any idea who he is, his character, his intent, his purpose, his nature, what he is saving, those he saves, what is he saving them to? And don't you think you may want to get to know him and engage in a relationship with him before you ask to be saved by him? You know, saved
by what? No, because most people are just terrified of hell.
Right.
And they think if they're not saved by Jesus Christ, they're going to go to hell.
Yeah. And the fact is, they're not going to hell. And number two, Jesus Christ can't save you.
There's that. And there's also another, they're leeches, they're parasites. You know, it takes a real parasite to walk up to somebody and ask for something for nothing at all.
Correct.
I mean, it does.
Yeah.
And, you know, Yahweh's no different. He's saying, okay, I want you to engage in my words, listen to me,
right,
and react to them.
Right. If you're not willing to listen to him, why would he want to spend eternity with you?
Right, and he's not even telling us to react perfectly. He wants to see a reaction.
Correct.
You know, and you know, we're reacting in the best way we know, which may be, you know, hopelessly small in the scheme of things.
It's
but
enough.
At least we understand it.
Yeah, it's enough.
And sure. Yeah, I believe it is enough. And
it's enough.
It's going to have to be, you know.
Right.
Because I can't cook a Pesach lamb. I can't come out with seven bowls and seven lamb. You know, I don't have all that. I can't.
Right. Right.
But I can understand.
And it's for darn sure you can't drip the blood of the lamb on the mercy seat, and is the ark of the covenant.
That's right.
No. So
I can't go into Sheol.
But you sure as heck can understand what he is inviting you to. You can engage in the covenant.
That's
and,
right.
And that way we are prepared to be saved and withdrawn. We have been equipped. We have to be both equipped and empowered. And that's one of the beauties of Shalatz. It talks about being equipped and empowered. How are you equipped? Well, you're transitioned from a fleshy mortal being to a spiritual being. You know, we were talking with IQ Abersuli this morning about Islam, and Islam is so screwed up, as is Christianity, thinking there's a bodily resurrection, that you're going to have a body as an eternal being. I mean, if you've ever studied science, if you have any concept of the law of thermodynamics, if you have any concept in the nature of those things which are physical, you know that it is impossible to have a physical body in eternity. It is it's a liability.
Physical
and
impossibility.
Beyond that, you could never. I mean, even God could not bring together every cell that represented your body and reanimate your physical body. It's not possible. And it's not possible for a lot of reasons. One is that our body is always changing. Cells are constantly dying. They're replacing each other. So what cells is it going to be? Is it going to be when I was a baby? I don't want that body. Or is it going to be an old man? I don't want that body. And then on top of that, once you die...
Quite frankly, none of the bodies I've had in my life do I want.
Right. And, you know, and once you die, your body, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, it becomes the part of the material that other organisms consume. I mean, you know, you're going to have to borrow from the worm and then borrow from the shrub that consumed the worm. I mean, it's fertilizer. It's just absurd. You have to be prepared to be equipped and empowered. You have to have a transition from mortal to immortal, from material to energy. And then,
you know, sharing some words with a guy, and you know, the people that come off for 2 days constantly pounding you with every other question, they're the ones that'll never make it. You know, I've found that out. And you know, I shared with him that out of the toil, he will see the light and find satisfaction. Now, this is speaking of Yahusha's nefesh or soul.
Right.
It's in Sheol, the fulfillment of matzah.
Right.
And I says, okay, so we've got a soul.
And by the way, for those who think that see the light is a reference to that he's going to come out of Sheol physically as a body and see the sun, I would ask you, what time did the women arrive at the empty tomb?
It was before daylight.
Correct. And so what time did Yosha leave Sheol? Middle of the night.
Daylight.
Before daylight. Right, before daylight. The reference to see the light is, what is the last thing that Yosha said before he gave up his body and allowed his body to be sacrificed at the sacrificial lamb.
Why have you forsaken me? And of
my
course,
God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Correct. So what that means is,
spirit of
right.
Yahweh. That's the,
so
the
light that he is going to see is the set apart spirit departed him so that the physical body could be sacrificed as the sacrificial lamb, as the Passover lamb, and the light that he's going to see, that is predicted that he would see, is he's reunited with Yahweh's maternal light. That's why four of the seven Mikrae ask us, invite us, to walk, to answer the call, and to walk into the presence of the maternal aspect of Yahweh's light.
You know, that's the point. So
that's how we're prepared. That's how we're equipped.
What I brought up to him was that you'll notice that we've got a soul here. We've got light here, which speaks of Yahweh's spirit. But there's no physical being talked about. And he went up to the room where, but what about Thomas? And I said, so you think that in a physical being, you can reach a hand inside another body? Really?
And you think that a physical being could walk through that wall?
Is that
what the physical being did? Yeah, physical being walked through the wall.
Never heard
anything. And by the way, if he was in the same body, why didn't anybody recognize it?
Well, I've asked him this, but then he had to get stuck on this Thomas. You know,
the answer on Thomas is that that when you become spiritual, when you become an energy-based entity, because M equals MC squared, you can dial that back your energy and become matter at any time of your choosing. And you can go from matter back to energy at any time of your choosing. And so all he did is say, all right, if you're going to be stuck on the physical, if the spiritual recognition isn't resonating with you, Thomas, let me manifest a spiritual aspect that might resonate with you. And he simply showed him his wrists. And the next time, the disciples were camping out and having breakfast together was by the Sea of Galilee, wasn't it? Did they recognize him then?
No, they didn't again. They blew it again.
You know, every time they don't recognize him until he wants them to recognize him.
Correct.
It could easily be said he made one body, talked with them, and then when he wanted them to know who he was, he made that body look like his original body. Simple answer.
Yeah.
And
by the way, I'm not even sure. I'm not even sure he did that. I don't think he. In fact, I'm fairly confident he didn't do that. I think he may have said, "All right, you want to see nail holes in a wrist? All right, here's nail holes in a wrist." Does it say that he changed the rest of his appearance?
No.
I don't think he did. So he came in an appearance, in a body, if you will, that they could not recognize. And all it says was, all right, here, I'll materialize, I'll manifest a nail hole in my wrist. Is that going to help you out? But
well, not only that, how do you reach inside a wound in a body? I mean, I've never seen that done on a physical body. I've seen plenty of wounds. It just doesn't work like that. You can't just re-injure the person is what you do.
Yeah. Why did Yosha tell the women who came to see him before first light, don't touch me? If he was a physical body, if he had his regular body back, they touched him all the time. Why all of a sudden can't they touch him?
He said he hadn't been back to the Father.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Because he was in this transition between this spiritual construct. I mean, it is pretty straightforward. It is easy to understand. It is magnificent. I mean, the actual story of what occurred and the testimony about it, and, you know, the testimony that you're sharing with them was written anywhere from 750 to 1,000 years before it occurred.
Before it took place.
Right.
That's
the most, the most detailed, the most accurate, in fact, the only detailed and accurate eyewitness account of what occurred on Pesach, on the Matzah and Bukkotim in 33 CE, year 4000 Yah, was written 750 years to 1,000 before these events transpired. And wouldn't you think that with that being the case, you'd pay attention to what the else the Torah prophets and Psalms have to say?
You might do that. Yeah, might be a good idea.
And by the way, if the Torah was irrelevant, why did Yahusha serve as the Passover lamb? Why did he rematerialize and go to the Father as the Son on firstborn children?
Well, of course, but then with these people, you get right in, they get right into he fulfilled the Torah. It's dead.
Yeah.
You know,
so if he fulfilled the Torah, why does he say and if fulfilling the Torah does away with the Torah? Why did he say before then, do not think that I came to do away with the Torah?
Exactly.
How can you have the conclusion that to fulfill means to do away with when the immediate previous statement by Yahusha says, do not think that I came to do away with?
Yeah, I've not come to abolish, annul, take down one letter of the Torah, not in any way, shape, or form.
Right,
they
right.
They already fulfilled it. It's gone. It's abolished.
Why don't you read the previous statement that he made? And if you can't realize that fulfill cannot mean do away with in the context of him saying, do not think I've come to do away with, then you're too stupid for words. Then you can't be fixed.
Well, I mean,
just go away. I don't want to talk to you anymore. At that point, I'm dealing with a dunderhead.
Yeah, well, I blocked him. I mean, I gave him every reason why the Torah still existed, and why Paul's letters are nonsense. And at the end of it all, he stuck on grace through Jesus is saving me. I never would have engaged this.
Take a God and a person unknown to history. There you go.
Yeah.
All right.
Exactly.
So you
the imaginary caricature.
Yeah, that is correct. So you have chosen to prepare me so that I'm ready to be saved and withdrawn. Because indeed, so why did Yahweh choose to prepare Dode so he could be saved and withdrawn? Does Dode provide the answer? Perhaps because indeed I have not ignored, overlooked, lost sight of, nor responded inappropriately to your Torah. So did the Torah save Dode?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did the Torah prepare Dode to be in the presence of Yahweh?
Yes, it did.
Yes, did Yahweh choose to prepare and save Dode and withdraw Dode from this world because he thought that the Torah had been annulled?
No.
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 Why is Dode singing the praises of the Torah? Here it's saying the only reason that God chose to save Dode. You know, because Dode had a pretty raspy, checkered past. The only reason that Yahweh chose to save Dode was because that he had not lost sight of the Torah. He didn't respond inappropriately to the Torah. Saying the Torah has been annulled, that would be the full extreme of responding inappropriately to it. I guess you could want
to first
call it pedagogy.
That would be the total opposition. That's what the man of no Torah, the guy they call Antichrist,
right.
He'll be pro-Christ. He'll be anti-Torah. He'll be just like Paul.
Yeah. So this whole psalm is focused on the purpose of the Torah and how to observe the Torah. And Dode is saying that when you observe the Torah, Yahweh wants, to see you respond. He wants to see you answer the call. He wants to see you engaged. He wants to prepare you so that you can be saved when you properly focus on and pay attention to the Torah. It is everything. It is the only way you can come to know who Yahweh is. He is unknowable through any other means other than the Torah. It is the only way that you can find the terms and conditions of the covenant and the benefits of the covenant. It's the only place that you can find a path that Yahweh has provided for his children to be saved. That's it. There's no other place for any of these things. There's no other place you can go to understand any of this. But in that one place, you've got all of the information you need to understand all of it. It seems so simple. You know, it, I guess it was to Dote. It is to us. Then this goes on to say, what it's now explaining is the means that Yahweh uses to redeem, to vindicate, to restore those who are prepared to be saved and withdrawn by focusing on the Torah. It says, you want to present the argument to defend me, arguing the case on my behalf based upon my choices, and you genuinely seek to redeem me because you have chosen to restore me so that I might live according to your word, your instruction, and your promise. Now, it's interesting here that in the Rib Reba, you want to present the argument to defend me, arguing the case on my behalf because of my choices, that you have two expressions of volition. You know, I have to tell you, the first time I translated this, I didn't pay attention to volition at all. I just wasn't diligent in terms of the moods. And the second time I went through it, I expressed volition, but I did not fully recognize that there was a dual expression of volition in this particular statement, riba. And the first expression of commission of desire is the imperative, second person. This is speaking of Yahweh choosing, Yahweh wanting. So Yahweh wants to present the argument to defend us. But the second is the paragogic. This paragogic is a first-person expression of volition. So it speaks of the desire, the choices, the free will of the speaker. In this case, Dode. So it has to be Dode's choices, that Dode made choices that Yahweh, that are such that Yahweh desires defending him. So because of the choices Dode made, Yahweh wants to defend him. What choice did Dode make in the previous statement? He chose to respond to the invitation. He chose to engage in the covenant. He chose to diligently study and focus upon the Torah.
Right? You know, in that day and time, they were probably... The way he was responding, he was probably by himself or close to it. I don't know if he could have been doing it with a group because the group would have been dumbed down to rituals by then.
Right.
They were all against him, or at least
we have enormous advantages over Dode. We have enormous advantages over Moshe. We have enormous advantages over Noah. We have enormous advantages over any one of the children of Israel that was led out of Egypt. We have enormous advantages over even Yosha's disciples or those that lived and witnessed his Sermon on the Mount. Our advantages are tremendously beyond that, because not only do we have access to his testimony and the tools to study it, to properly observe it, but also we have this marvelous technology that enables us via the telephone, via the internet, to communicate together, to share together, to learn together. This is the best time to live in terms of coming to know Yahweh. I don't think it's ever been easier for somebody to diligently observe the Torah, to respond to Yahweh's invitations, to engage in the covenant, than it is right now at this moment. I think God is more easily known right now at this moment than he has ever been.
The counter to that is we have more distractions available than ever before.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I didn't say that it was so easy that it didn't take focus or effort or desire. I think it's always taken focus, effort, and desire. But and while there are more distractions, Yahweh is more easily known. If you want to know him,
It's there.
It's there, and if you then want to join the company of others who not only know him but celebrate their relationship with him, you know, here we are around the world, and our friends in New Zealand and Australia and throughout Europe, South America, Central America, Mexico, you name it. It's easy to fellowship now. Easy to know. This is a marvelous time. But when we observe the Torah, when we respond to Yahweh's invitations, when we engage in the covenant, Yahweh is in a position as a father that he wants, he's desiring the defending us. You know, and once we make the choice to get to know him, to respond to his invitations, and to engage in the covenant, it is his desire to save us. Then he wants to argue the case on our behalf. You know, if I had to go to trial, and fortunately, yes, children aren't tried, but if I have to go, I'd just as soon have the creator of the universe as my advocate.
Yeah.
Particularly when that's the job that he wants. You know, that's what Dota's saying. And what does Yahweh want to do? He genuinely wants, he seeks to redeem us. And, you know, that's, you know, we're flawed individuals, all of us. We have to be redeemed. That's the purpose of matzah, is to redeem us. And then it says, because you have chosen to restore me so that I might live. Well, the purpose of Pesach is to restore our lives so that we might live. You know, matzah redeems, Pesach restores life. You answer those invitations after having engaged in the covenant, those are the benefits. And it's, how do you find those benefits? Is it by faith? No. Is it by ignorance? Nope. Is it by God loving everybody and wanting to save everybody? Nope. Is it by being a little child because God loves all the little children? Nope. To approach according to your word, your instruction, and your promise. Imra. You know, there's two Hebrew words for words, Dabar and Imra. Dabar is word as in a statement. Imra is word as in instruction and promise. Imra is a better word for word in this particular case because Imra is really synonymous with the aspect of the Torah that Dode is addressing, which is Yahweh's promises and his instructions.
You know, it bears repeating. We've talked about this before, but it bears repeating for anyone who's new, you know, the nature of Hebrew poetry. And the way, you know, the couplets are used, where you say the same thing in two different words. So your Imra, in relation with 153, is your Torah.
Correct.
Yeah, you can link the two completely that way. Yeah, that's like I said. You know, for anyone who hasn't listened before, that's the nature of Hebrew poetry, and that's what makes it really so interesting and so informative.
Right. Exactly. And in this case, we know that these two are the couplets that are paired, because they're the first two statements brought to us by the Hebrew letter Resh. Resh is the Hebrew letter that's drawn with the head of a man. And it speaks of first and foremost. And it speaks of using your eyes and your ears to see and to listen so that you can know, and your head, your brain, so that you can understand, and your mouth so that you can respond. And so it's a person drawn as a profile indicating this is the letter that speaks of seeing, which is to observe, listening so as to know, thinking so as to understand, and using your mouth so that you can respond to that which is first and foremost. And these are the first two statements brought to us by the letter Resh. So Imra and Torah are being presented as an equivalent concept. by the whole notion of Hebrew poetry, of the couplets. And therefore, Torah is equivalent to instruction, word, and promise. And that's it. I mean, Yahweh's promise are the benefits of the covenant. Yahweh's promise are the results of us attending the Mikra. His instructions are to engage in observing the Torah so that we come to know who he is, so that we understand that there is a path to him, so that we understand there are terms and conditions of the covenant. That's his instruction, all contained in his word. And his promise is to do as he has said he would do. So then this goes on to present a little different thought, but still under the same letter. Those who remain liable for violating the standard, Rasha, those who retained their guilt, are at a great distance from Yahshua, salvation, because they do not seek nor consult your engraved and clearly communicated prescriptions of what we should do in life if we want to be cut into the relationship. Choke. You know, he has spent 154 statements trying to define for us four concepts in the Torah. Choke is one of those four. Choke is based upon creating, inscribing something in stone, cutting it into stone, etching it, inscribing it. So he's talking about what did Yah inscribe his Torah? And it speaks of cutting into. What do we cut into? The Torah is karat, cut. Yahweh always says the Torah is karat, cut. So we're cut into the Torah based upon what Yahweh cut into stone, what he inscribed in his Torah. Cuts us into the covenant relationship. That's what choke means. That's the etymology of choke. Dode has covered choke now probably 30 or 40 times. He's telling us here that if you want to embrace salvation, if you actually want to benefit from Yahusha, from Yahweh's salvation, the means to do so is Yahweh's choke, the clearly communicated prescriptions which are engraved, inscribed, of what we should do to be cut into the relationship. Now, what he's saying here is also indicative of why Christianity is so harmful. So, if you're a Christian and you're not paying attention to, because you've rejected the Torah, and you're not paying attention to the engraved inscriptions that cut us into the relationship, then according to the words Yahweh inspired Dode to write, you are a great distance from salvation, and you are a great distance. You're alienated from Yahusha. So rather than being saved, this says you're not paying attention to the choke, which could only be found in the Torah, where Yahweh inscribed his words, where he engraved his message in stone. If you aren't paying attention to the Torah, you are a great distance from salvation, and you are alienated from Yahusha. Yahusha said the same thing, didn't he, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount? He said, you know, get away from me, all of those who, you know, call me Lord, Lord, who claim to have done all these wonderful things in my name. Get away from me, because I do not know you. He said exactly the same thing. So if you violate the standard, and because you pay no attention to, you don't consult Yahweh's choke, his inscribed teachings, instructions, guidance that cuts us into the relationship, then there is no salvation. So God would be a liar if he saved someone that did not know him, if he saved someone who was adverse to the Torah. If you're not Torah observant, according to Yahweh, you are not only not saved, you are a great distance from salvation, and you're alienated from Yahusha. That's pretty indicting, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah,
well,
I'd say so.
It's clear, too. Yeah, it's very clear. I mean, you violated the standard. You
right.
violate a standard, that's the end of it. You know,
right.
And that's why there is a standard.
Yeah. Now, you can violate the standard. Doe did. I have. Larry, you probably haven't, but
I have.
Yeah. You know, you can violate the standard. We violated the standard. But if you are observing the Torah diligently and responding to Yahweh's invitations to meet with him and engaging in the covenant,
you're not liable.
You know, then God's going to defend you. But if you're not paying attention to the instructions that are inscribed in the Torah, then God's not going to defend you, and you're a great distance from salvation. You're alienated from the source of salvation, from Yahweh's
sake. I mean, we all have a tendency to do that. That's only fair. You know,
it
if
is.
You ask somebody to do something and they did it to the best of their ability, they were honestly trying, you were watching them, and you saw some guy over here, you told him the same thing, he did none of it. You know, who are you going to pick, you know, to be on your team? The guy that tried. That's it.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, that goes without saying. It's like people walk into these religious matrix
right.
systems and advanced religious platforms. They make all this stuff up on their own. I mean, they do. Every bit of it,
yeah.
if you start looking at it, it's just all made up. It's,
yeah, put it really
well,
simple.
They have help.
Let's say you're walking by a lake, and and it's frozen, and two people have inadvertently fallen through the ice. And one person just gives up. You see them throw their arms in the air, and they sink to the bottom of the lake. And you see the other person flailing in the water, reaching out, trying to crawl back on the ice, trying to
that's the person you're going
to
try to
help.
You're not going to dive into the yeah exactly. You know. Yeah,
yeah,
I'm with you.
Or if you let's just say that you're in a situation where it's a rough storm at sea, and two people fall off the boat, and you are the captain. And you have a life ring and a rope. And you tell the two people, swim towards the boat. I want you to pay attention. I'm going to throw you this life ring. I'm going to keep it on a rope. If you'll put this life ring around your neck and under your arms, I will pull you in. And one person is paying attention to you and say, throw me the rope. I'm going to grab hold of it. And the other person turns away and says, I don't need
turns
your dad.
Turns around and swims away from
you. I'll go, I'm going to go save myself. I think I'm going to go swim in the other direction. Who are you going to save?
One who's coming towards
you. That goes without
the
saying.
The one that there's chance of saving.
Yes, exactly. Great, Rob. Is your mercy and your compassion, Rock Chamon, Yahweh. So you will be merciful to me, Chesed, according to your means to resolve disputes and achieve justice, Misvot. So what is, first of all, let's deal with just Misvot because it's the end. Choke has been mentioned some 40 times. Misvot has been mentioned some 40 times. It's the second of the four characteristics and main themes of the Torah that Dode throughout this 176 statement presentation of eight statements regarding each of the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. He is telling us over and over again, some 40 times, pay attention to Choke, which he's just reinforced, and pay attention to Misvot. Now, this is all about Yahweh wanting to save us, Yahweh wanting to bring the case to ransom us. How does Yahweh defend us? How does he prepare us for salvation? How does he redeem us?
Do the Mishpat.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. There's no other way for that to happen. That's why I can't understand when you clearly show these Misbot to the and these seven Moed Mikra, I should say, to the people who want to follow Paul's letters. They act like they don't exist.
Right.
They act like for some reason, this huge plan that was developed way back in the Torah, in Korah,
right,
didn't really happen. All that happened was somehow blood smeared on a pagan cross saved them.
Their God died.
It is outrageous.
Yeah, their God died.
That saved them.
Right, their God died. Look, their God allowing man to kill him saved them. Some God, huh?
Yeah.
You know, when we're dealing with a mishpat, a means to resolve disputes and achieve justice, we're having to deal with Yahweh's means to resolve disputes and achieve justice, to redeem and to prepare for salvation. That's the theme thus far that has been presented in words and promises and instructions that not only Dode had access to, but that had to be contained in the one book that Dode has constantly been referencing, the Torah. So, anyway, does Yahweh say in the Torah that the means that I have used to ransom you, to redeem you, to prepare you for salvation, is allowing men to kill me? Did he say that anywhere?
No, he didn't. And he,
no.
And by the way, the whole blood on the pole thing, you know, Yahweh said that he took the strokes due the family. The family.
Yes.
Due the family. Simple as that. And if he's taken the strokes due the family, he's obviously taken the strokes for the family.
Right.
Not for anybody else. Not for people that aren't family.
And by the way, the upright pole that when you have the eyewitness account of what occurred on Pesach with the Passover lamb, does it ever once mention a pagan cross?
No. It's the
even in the
one.
Greek eyewitness the account, does the Greek text use a term for pagan cross? For cross?
No.
No.
Kraios.
Upright pole.
Right. Upright pole. Upright pillar. And he didn't speak, it doesn't communicate in Hebrew, Greek. At least if you examine the Greek, you'll have an idea that it was the upright one standing up for us so that we could stand for him. And where did the blood go? The blood of the Pesach lamb on Passover, where did it go?
It was dripped on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant.
Right, directly below. That's why the earth opened up. That's why there was the earthquake. That's why the earth opened up. That's why the Ark of the Covenant, the mercy seat, is directly below the receptacle for the upright pole upon which he hung. And by the way, the pole upon which he hung, the Roman means to crucify, was not on a cross. Not on the kind of cross that Christians have as their symbol. That kind of cross is pagan. The upright pole was that the upright pole, which was probably, I would say on average, 6 to 8 feet tall, was from a olive tree, which was really the only wood that would have been in Israel at the time. If you ever looked at an olive tree, they don't grow very tall. And the trunk of the olive tree is very seldom more than 6 to 8 feet. And that pole has to sit into a receptacle that's cut into the limestone so it doesn't teeter over. So it's got to be 8 inches into the limestone. Once it's set into the limestone, that vertical pole that would now, let's say it was an average of 7 feet, now it's an average of 6 feet above ground because it's got to set into the receptacle, cut into, chiseled into the limestone. Do you think they pull it out? They don't. And the horizontal member of, you know, because it, you know, Jan was talking about Pesach and the doorway that comprises Pesach and it's the upright and then also the horizontal where the blood of the Pesach lamb is to be sprinkled. That horizontal piece did not get nailed to or screwed to or bolted to the pole a foot down from the top. That would be stupid. They didn't do it that way.
Guy standing on the ground with his neck, you know, his arm stretched out, but he'd be standing on the ground.
Of course, you know, it would make it almost impossible to reuse under that basis. What happened was
they were very commonly reused.
That the individual had their wrists either nailed or tied to a horizontal piece. and that horizontal piece had a indentation cut into the center of it, and then there was a protrusion at the top of the upright pole, and it's like the old peg and notch concept. All they had to do is stand on a rock on both sides, and somebody would lift the upright pole and set it down. I mean, the horizontal piece, they would lift it and set it on top of that upright pole, the upright pillar, and there you go. It would look like a capital T. And
I'm looking at a picture of one now. It says genuine crucifixion pole, as opposed to what we see today.
Right.
Yeah. It's a capital T as opposed to a small T.
Right.
Is what it is.
Right. While it doesn't matter what the implement was, other than to depict the Christian symbol is wholly inaccurate and wholly pagan, it does matter that the upright pole was firmly into the limestone of Mount Moriah, directly above the Ark of the Covenant. That's all meaningful. That's meaningful. And that the upright one, the Edon of the tabernacle, stood up for us in that place on the upright pole. And that there was a horizontal piece to tie it into the specific instructions of Pesach during the Exodus. All of that matters. All right, so Yahweh is saying here, and this is an interesting presentation. It says, great, Rob, especially abundant and significant. That's why you don't ever want to be called a rabbi. If somebody refers to themselves as a rabbi, they're egotistical and presumptuous. Rabbi is based on the Hebrew word Rob, which means great and significant.
Exalted.
Exalted. Is your mercy and compassion, Rakamim. Rakam is the basis of Abraham's name, Ab from Hebrew for father, and Rakam meaning merciful, so it's merciful father,
mm-hmm.
merciful father.
Yeah.
And the YM makes it plural, which means that we're talking about multiple concepts associated with mercy, more than one. Yahweh's mercy is multiplicitous. Willingness to provide unearned and undeserved favor, Yahweh. And by the way, is the mercy here coming from Jesus Christ?
No.
Is the mercy here coming from a Gentile and pagan church?
No.
Is the mercy coming from the Roman Catholic Church?
No.
No. No. Great is your mercy and compassion, Rakamim, Yahweh. Now, for him first to use the mercy as Rakam, which is not the principal word for mercy in the Torah. The principal word for mercy in the Torah is Chesed, which
chesed,
follows.
Chesed, yeah.
Now, for him to first use Rakamim, I've already given you a hint as to why he chose Rakamim before, or Rakam, the plural Rakamim, but Rakam, why do you think he chose great, significant, and abundant, Rob, is your mercy and compassion, Rakam, before he mentioned Chesed? Anybody got an idea as to why it appears this way?
I'm all ears.
What is the means to mercy? What do you have to do before you are prepared to accept Yahweh's invitations and to meet with him on Pesach and Matzah so that you can benefit from Bikurim? What do you first have to do?
You have to engage
away
in
from religion.
Right. Got to engage in the covenant, right? Who was the person for whom the covenant
Abraham.
Was first created? What was his name?
That's why. Yeah, Abraham.
Abraham. There you go. And so what he's doing here, Yahweh's clever. I mean, he's clever in the most magnificent concept of that word. He loves giving us clues that we can discover that help us understand. If we're willing to invest the time and be diligent, if we're willing to closely examine and carefully consider, there's just nuggets everywhere. And so great is your mercy and compassion, Rachamim, via the covenant that he established with Abraham. That's why Racham is used here. So you want to be merciful to me, Chesed, because you have decided to treat me favorably. All right, this was written in the Peel. Now, what in the heck is the Peel, you might say? And by the way, I have come to love this stuff. I hate grammar. I'm really lousy at grammar. I flunked grammar in school. If it wasn't for classes apart from grammar, I would never have graduated. So I don't pretend to be good at this. But that nonetheless, I enjoy it, and I hope you do too. And so I'm not trying to be pedantic when we get into the detail here and the grammar of it. Peel is one of the Hebrew stems. Everything we have considered up to this point has been the call stem. The call stem speaks of a genuine relationship and a statement which we should understand literally, that this is something that is actual, that it is genuine, that it's and it's literal regarding a relationship. That's the call stem. Everything's been the call stem that we have considered thus far. This is not. There's a change. Now, do you think that God changed the stem here just because he was bored and said, I'll throw a little left hook here and some grammar? Or maybe there is something we can learn from the change in the stem.
Okay,
so
for it.
Yeah, so what can we learn? In the Peel stem, the object is influenced and affected by the action of the verb. Who's the object? And who's the subject? Yahweh is the subject, right? Yahweh. And the object is Dod, you and me. Okay? So, in the Peel stem, the object, you and me, are influenced by the action of the verb. What's the action of the verb? Chesed. Mercy. Undeserved favor. Being treated favorably, being given something that is better than we deserve. And so the Peel says that Yahweh influences and affects the individual who has observed his Torah, and that we're influenced by this, that there is an effect of all of this. It's actionable on Yahweh's part to our benefit. All right, it was written in the imperative. And we know the imperative is second-person volition. It's being written about Yahweh. You, Yahweh, is the subject. And by the way, it's interesting also to know here that if you're reading along in an English Bible or you're just using the standard study tools, you will not see chesed here, the word for mercy. You know what word you're actually going to see?
What would put in there? Grace or something?
Chaya.
What
life. Chaya, life.
Okay.
So the Masoretic text has Chaya, life. The Dead Sea Scrolls have Chesed, mercy. So rather than saying...
Why would they do that?
I know. Here it's... And they're very different words, obviously. But, great, especially abundant and significant is your mercy and compassion, Rakam, through the covenant, by being the merciful Father. Your willingness to provide unearned and undeserved favor, Yahweh. So you want to be life to me. Chaya, life. You want to be life to me. It makes no sense. So you want to be merciful to me, chesed. And that's what you find in the Qumran scrolls, is chesed. You want to be merciful to me. And how is Yahweh being merciful? In accordance with his means to resolve disputes and achieve justice. He is merciful to us and wants to be merciful to us according to the plan that he articulated and the plan that he himself fulfilled. He doesn't say that he
Maybe
wants to be merciful to us based upon our faith, does it?
No, not at all. No. I think that they came to understand that he fulfilled the mitzvah, and so therefore they had to have that change there. And
yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. It's
right.
Like lions mauling your feet and hands again,
right. All right, James, we've come to Chesed, and you wrote the following. that of the 133 times that chesed is found in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, that it is translated into Greek not by the Christian term, not by the Pauline term of charis, grace, but by an entirely different Greek word, isn't it?
Actually, I think you might have misread what I wrote. It's the Greek word was used 133 times and was used as a translation of Chanan 37 of those times.
Okay. So, and the Greek word...
There is another Greek word that conveys the term mercy or Chanan other than charis.
Right.
And I'm going to butcher this.
Ilio is the Greek word for mercy. Greeks have a word for mercy. It's Ilio is the Greek word for mercy. It translates Chanan 37 times. It translates Rakam 21 times. It translates Kamal, which is to spare and to show mercy, 7 times. It translates Nakam, which is to comfort, 5 times. And so, in the Greek Septuagint, which is a translation of the Hebrew, they did not use charis to translate the concept of chanan or chesed, mercy. It's ilio. Anyway, the fact is that Yahweh's means to communicate is Hebrew. And if you want to understand his means to achieve justice and resolve disputes, you've got to observe the Torah in its original language, Hebrew. And the terms for mercy are chesed and rakam. And they both convey mercy, undeserved favor. And they are applied based upon the mitzvah. All right. Those who pursue and persecute me are abundant, they're powerful, and they're adversarial. So from your enduring testimony and restoring witness, I do not so much as lean away or turn aside. I think we have all been in a position where we have been pursued, where we had people who sought to bring us down or to harm us or to do us in. And when that happens and you're pursuing personal or selfish interests, you know, might just be your business interests, you can feel pretty lonely out there. I mean, I've been in positions in business where I had competitors and foes that tried to destroy my relationships with my productive relationships. And, man, I'll tell you what, when you're being hunted and pursued and having people work against you like that, it's pretty lonely. But I'll tell you something else. When you are pursuing Yahweh's message, when you are sharing Yahweh's words, then no matter how hostile someone is to you, it does not matter. So long as you stay consistent with, you cling to Yahweh's testimony, his restoring witness, then there is nothing that those who are foes, those who are adversaries can do. But, you know, there's two things I think being communicated here. If you don't vary from what Yahweh Edah says, which is his enduring testimony and restoring witness, if you do not lean away from it, if you don't turn aside from it, you are going to have adversaries. Your adversaries are going to be abundant, and they're going to be powerful, and they're going to try to pursue and persecute you. That's the first part of this. And the second is that when that occurs, so long as you stay consistent with his testimony, if you don't lean away from it, it won't matter. I see both of those being conveyed here. What about you guys?
Absolutely.
Yeah. No doubt about it.
And I'm not even sure which one is more important to know. Because I can tell you without exception that if you cling to, if you don't lean away from Yahweh's Eduth, his enduring testimony and restoring witness, which is the Torah, and his Torah as it appears in the prophets and Psalms, you're not only going to have adversaries, they are going to be many, they're going to be powerful, and they're going to pursue you. Statement of fact. What did they do to Yahusha, who was the perfect emissary of, I mean, right at the core, never leaned away from Yahweh's eternal testimony and restoring witness? What do they do to him?
Yeah, I'm hearing that.
Yeah, yeah. And his adversaries were abundant, they were powerful, and they pursued and persecuted him, right?
They were everywhere. Yeah,
right.
They were everywhere, and they ran everything. Just right. Like today.
And
I mean, they
just
did.
Like today. So you ought to expect that if you're going to be consistent. If you're going to cling to Yahweh's testimony, you ought to expect this. And then you ought to realize the way that Dode wrote this is that even though that is going to occur, it's even more important to realize that by clinging to, by not leaning away from, by embracing and not thrusting aside Yahweh's testimony, that it doesn't matter. That it really doesn't matter. There's
well, you said earlier, and you're right. You know, it's not like your physical body's going to go. I mean,
right.
it's done. It's finished
right.
No matter
yeah,
what.
So, right. Yeah, you can have my physical body. Go ahead and take it. You know, it's...
Well, I mean, that's
I'm a beneficiary.
Good. Yeah, it can come right down to that, and then that's the way it is.
Right.
So, I think I'd laugh at him a little. I really
yeah,
would.
Yeah, I would too. Yeah, thank you for hurrying me along. I mean, I have work still that I would like to have accomplished on behalf of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and I would have loved to have other people know, but, you know... For you to hurry me along is to my benefit, so have at it. See if I care. I have actually seen, I have literally witnessed in the Call Perfect, their treachery and their trickery, beget, their unreliable, deceptive, and dishonest betrayals. And I have let myself become angry because of them, coming to be disgusted by them, and loathing those, hating those. This is kut, allowing myself to be grieved by their actions, which has caused me to despise. This is in the hypotal, imperfect, wa consecutive, paragogic. We'll examine that in a moment. Who do not literally and completely observe lo shamar, who do not totally explore, examine, investigate, or actually consider call perfect, your Imra, your word, your instruction, your promise. All right, so, Larry, you know, it used to be that I was given a lot of grief for being suffering fools poorly and coming to despise those who don't shamar, observe, carefully examine and closely consider, you know, Yahweh's instruction, his testimony, his promise, his Torah. And you have done a marvelous service for me in that you're even more disparaging and hostile to those who corrupt, those who distance themselves from Yahweh's testimony than I am. But what it's saying here is that makes you more like Dode. The more hostile you are, the more you hate, the more you despise those who do not observe Yahweh's instructions, the more you're like Dode, and the more you're like Dode, the more Yahweh loves you. So,
well, this is a good thing, then.
By despising, you become more lovable.
Yeah, well...
Yeah, isn't that a marvelous
thing? I think we went through
thing?
That today on Shattering Myths. You know, it's not like Yahweh's this caricature out looking to bump into people and forgive them on every level for every little thing. He wants people that actually want to get to know him and take him seriously. And the idea that Yahweh loves everybody is nonsense. It would have to, anyone, as you said, that loved everyone would have to be insane.
Right.
Be insane.
Yeah, they're not worth knowing. They're not worth knowing because they're repulsive. They have relationships with and actually like people who are who are cutting off other people's heads, who are engaged in torture. Listen, I don't want to know anybody who thinks that Dick Cheney's a good guy. I don't want to know anybody that thinks that by being the most prolific killer, the sniper that the movie is out about now, that by being the most prolific killer in American history, that they're somehow a hero. I don't want to have a relationship with a God who would say, yeah, that's my guy, I really love him. I just don't. No. But I do want...
It's gotten to the point with me where I see... when you sit on a social media, you're sitting there watching all these things go by. You know, these are statements or posts that other people make. The way FB works is you got this home page, okay? Then you got your home page. But the home page, anybody that's ever friended you, they can be writing whatever they're writing. And there is this constant barrage of worship of anyone who's in the military. Now,
yeah.
You know, I'm former military. My son's in the military.
Right.
I don't understand their way of thinking. Thank a veteran for your freedom, this and that, and on it goes.
And on it goes. And it's pervasive in our society.
Yeah, it's. I think that that is maybe one of the biggest religions. I've actually come to that point where I look at
military worship. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, patriotism that is at its core is military worship. Is probably the most universally accepted religion now in America. And you know, I don't know if it was Gallup or Pew that 6 months ago published their exhaustive interviews with Americans about the things that Americans distrusted and trusted. The only institution in America that received a significant majority
military.
Of Americans saying they trusted was the military.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And it's just reprehensible. I mean, it's the place where more women are sexually abused and raped than any other place in our society. It's the place where the most people, 600,000, are claiming post-traumatic stress syndrome and are taking $6,000 a month from the U.S. government.
When you gave that figure out, I was astonished. 600,000.
Thousand.
There's not
why
that
you,
many
why would
that's
you respect
been in a theater
people that are
of war
like that, right? And then it's the place where that people are so disoriented, where life has become so meaningless, where the very myth that the military is providing a service has become so erroneous that you have 80 of them every day taking their own life. 80 a day over the 10 years that we have been engaged in these stupid wars is almost 300,000. Why would you respect an institution that drives 300,000 of its of those who participated in it to commit suicide? Why would you respect an institution that squanders $1 trillion specifically training people to kill and making things that destroy? Why would you show an allegiance to an organization and claim that they're protecting your freedom when it has been generations since the claim could be made that anyone in the U.S. military actually defended America against invasion?
That you would do it because of the propaganda that's been pumped in your head ever since they marched you off to kindergarten and you started pledging allegiance to a flag.
Right.
That's why you would do it.
Yeah.
And standing and removing your hat, standing at attention for the playing of the national anthem before the flag of America.
I used to do those things. Yeah. I used to do those things. So
you know,
I was never religious,
but I was as patriotic as you could get.
Yeah, me too. You know, I watched the Rose Parade.
I was.
Did either of you guys watch the Rose Parade?
No.
No.
I was almost impossible for me to watch it. You know, it began with a flyover of the B-2, the stealth fighter, which is, you know, the biggest boondoggle in the history of the U.S. military, an airplane that has absolutely no function. And then it went from there to being dedicated to Zamperini, the real American hero. He was a hero. Why? Because he endured being tortured by the Japanese. And his slogan for life is that all things work together for good. Which is just the most stupid thing in the world. That would mean that you torture somebody and that's good. Oh yeah, that's a good thing. What we should do, what we need then is more torture because all things work together for good.
Well,
and then
blow up a market. That's good.
Right. So we got a military theme, and then one of the lead floats of the parade is a float to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Yeah, you're a real hero when you go off and die. By the way.
That tells me a lot. Those are like propaganda techniques.
Oh yeah.
And
one of the themes of a float was inspired when somebody serving the country and providing their freedom comes home to a loved one and it's celebrated in their homecoming. I mean, it went on and on and on. The first band was the Marine Corps Band. It went on. It was so obnoxious, and the commentators kept on. That same statement that, well, our debt of gratitude to those who serve, who keep us free, who enable us to watch parades like this. And they went on and on and on interviewing military and bowing down before of this God that we have made. This God whose principal purpose is to destroy and to kill. Weapons of war.
You know, what drives me crazy is this notion that, you know, the military is protecting our freedom. The military, which serves the government, and the government is the greatest threat to our freedom that exists on this planet right now. They are taking away our freedom at a faster rate than any threat from outside the country has.
Yeah, by the way, in that military.
Controlled by that government.
Yeah, by that military, if you try to express your freedom, your free will, and say, you know, I don't want to go where they want to send me. I want to go someplace else. What happens to you?
You're court-martialed.
Right. What happens in that military if you want to express your free will and you don't follow an order?
Yeah, you'll be court-martialed. I mean,
right.
you're going to be punished. It might be as serious, might be something as nothing as a captain's mask, might be a write-up. It could be a serious court-martial, general court-martial.
Yeah. What happens if you sign up for that military and you get into the middle of it and you decide, you know, this is not what they promised. This is abusive. I don't like having squandered my freedom. I'd like to leave.
Well, you go to prison, that's what.
That's right.
I mean,
yes, if you're not
killed just
by
the way
your unit.
Is.
And so you want to tell me how an institution that is the least free is protecting our freedom when they don't defend America's borders and that there's no one that has either the will or the ability to invade this country?
I've always said that. If you were really going to use the military to protect freedoms, they'd be on the border.
Put them on the oceans.
Right.
And obviously by going over and killing a million Iraqis, you haven't advanced freedom at all. You've created a lot of jihadists.
You've created a lot of enemies. I would tell you, if America deployed, how many ships in the Navy now, probably 350. If they deployed 150 ships on the Atlantic seaboard and 150 ships on the Pacific coast, how many foes do you think they would repel?
The military on each border, and you ain't never getting into America.
Well, but just tell me, if we deployed our 150 ships in the along the Atlantic, 50 ships in the Caribbean, and another 150 some odd ships along the Pacific coast, how many foes do you think that those ships would turn away? Are they going to encounter a battle group of Chinese? that are trying to attack and invade America?
No,
are they going
they
to turn away the Ruskies for trying to attack America?
They wouldn't encounter any foes because
nobody
would be so stupid.
They'd bob up and down and squander fuel and do absolutely nothing worthwhile.
Well, I
and
think
if we were
that's
to put,
why.
Let's just say we're going to put 300,000 troops along the Canadian border. What good would they do?
Nothing.
Let's say
nothing.
You put another 300,000 troops along the Mexican border. What are they going to do? Are they going to shoot? Are they going to shoot the Mexicans as they try to come across? Because it's a lot of them are little boys and little girls. Are they going to shoot them?
Well, no. What would happen is those borders would stop. But when you stop those borders,
how
would
they
also
stop
all?
How would they stop the borders? What is the military trained to do?
Well, they're trained to kill.
Right.
Do
you think we're going to stop immigration by putting the military there and having them shoot to kill those who try to cross the border?
Well, yeah, what I think is that would stop it, yes, but I do think that...
It would stop it. Would it be a proper way to stop it? You know, you can stop people from crossing the street by putting men with machine guns on the other side of the street. Is that the proper way to keep somebody from jaywalking?
It isn't, but you know
the
fact of the matter is that would never be done because there would be way too much drug money as far as I'm concerned.
Well, of course,
and I think the powers that be have a vested interest in keeping that border open. That's what I think. Or they
what Yahweh is saying here, though, in 119:158, is powerful. That I have seen their treachery and their trickery. I have seen propaganda. I have seen patriotism. I've seen military worship. I've seen the lies promoted by the heads of state, by presidents and senators. I've seen the false promises that they have made. I have seen the treachery and the trickery of the pastors and the clerics. I've seen it. I have seen their treachery and trickery. And I have let myself become angry because of them. And I'm disgusted by them. I have come to loathe those who do not observe your instructions and promise. Man, that is as it has to be. You were saying, we spent the second hour of Shattering Myths today talking about why it is inherent in love to hate. You have to hate those who use trickery and deceit, those who use treachery to promote ideas that are inconsistent with Yahweh's teaching. And
you
if
have
you
to
don't
confront
hate them,
them.
Right. If
you
don't
confront
them, if you don't hate them, if you don't loathe them, if you're not disgusted by them, then you don't love Yahweh. You don't love his testimony. You don't love the children of the covenant, the family.
You know, there's something else being pointed out here that, you know, I think it's pretty easy to forget. It's something I didn't even realize until I started reading these Psalms. David, Dode, was surrounded by people who did not like the Torah. These were his own people.
Yes. Correct.
These were his own people.
Right.
You would have thought at that time, I mean, I would have thought at that time, that most of the people would have been trying to follow the Torah. Clearly, Dode says they weren't.
They weren't.
And here he was in a position of power being attacked by them.
Correct.
So it tells us something else about power. As it consolidates towards the top, the people get more evil.
Yeah, actually, I think that the time that Dode wrote these Psalms, I think he was ostracized from power. I think that he wrote most of these Psalms when Shaul was king, when the people got their king. Mm-hmm. And and Shaul tried to hunt down and kill Dode. So I think that most of these reflect the same situation that we're in, where those who are empowered almost universally, whether it's religious power or political power, almost universally despise Yahweh's Torah.
But regardless, you would have thought Dode at that time would have been a great national treasure and hero, at least.
Right. Oh, yeah, you would. You would, for what he did.
You know, I mean, and here he is. He's He's talking about being surrounded by these beasts, constantly at war with them.
Right, that they're powerful and that they are numerous and that they're adversarial. And rather than love them, Dota said, no, I hate them. I'm disgusted by them.
You know, I told you earlier this week that I had a debate with a woman who claimed that the two pillars of the Torah is one, loving everyone. You know, she had said we're not sharing our love enough with our Christian, quote, brothers and sisters.
Well, they aren't our brothers.
And,
they aren't our sisters.
And
Dode would say, I hate them.
Apparently hers, not mine. Apparently hers, not mine. She was another one of these Yeshua HaMashiach, you know, got one foot in each religion guys. Anyway, I threw this out to her. Those with divided loyalties who are hypocritical, I hate and I am opposed to them.
Right.
No, that's dope.
And can you have more divided loyalties than being Pauline and rabbinical?
No.
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 I mean, that's as divided as it becomes. Or if you're one of these politically correct people that embraces you're tolerant of everything, so you've got the ultimate divided multicultural perspective. What you read here in the psalm is that God hates them. They're disgusting. They're loathsome. Yeah.
Yeah, but this is the whole concept with the omnipresent, all loving, back to the show and Shattered Myth, God. I mean, it's an insane proposition. It is a person who is a compromiser. It's a person who doesn't even believe what he says. This would describe most of the political actors today, wouldn't it? I mean,
I want my God and my Father to be devoted to protecting me against those who are adversarial. And to do that, both he and I must despise, must loathe those who wish to do the family harm. It's natural, it's sensible, it's moral, it's reasonable, it's real. You know, when we were talking about today on Shattering Myths, this is the statement that we should have cited. And then it doesn't become, anything other than, that's God's perspective.
That or with those with divided loyalties, I hate them. I mean, that's a pretty direct statement, you know. And I sit and I look at those things and I say to myself, all these people spend all this time claiming that they represent Yahweh's words and they're out sharing the words and sharing his precepts and concepts and nature. And what they're really doing is they're propping themselves up as an imaginary teacher. And one thing that they don't do, and this is universal amongst them all, is they never use his words. It's always their opinions.
Yeah. Correct. They never use his words. They always cite their opinion, or they cite Paul's opinion, but I, Paul, say they're more than willing to do that. But it's either their opinion or Paul's opinion. And
letters.
Paul's letters. Right. It's never Yahweh's and never Yahusha's.
Yeah, I know. And what I've found with these people, you know, because I'm in a situation, I copy and paste, put it in, I have notes, I can cover any debate subject you want.
Right.
And I have his words, and I lay those down. They don't like to debate me.
No. Because who are they debating?
In the end, they all run away.
Yeah, who are they debating?
Well, they're not debating me. I mean,
that's correct. Are you laying down? No. And that's what Dode says, that he's talking about the reality that if we adhere to what Yahweh says, if we cling to what he says, if we observe what he says, if we do our due diligence regarding his testimony, if we respond to his invitations, if we engage in the covenant based upon what we have learned through his promises in the Torah, that we're going to have lots of enemies. Their enemies are going to be powerful, and they're going to be aggressive, and that the appropriate response to them is to be disgusted by them and to despise them. That's it.
Yeah, well, you know, You'll get people that talk about somebody who killed one of their loved ones. I saw this yesterday, and he said, and I forgive him, but I still think he should be punished. Forgive him, but. You know, my position is, no, I don't forgive you.
No, and by the way, let's just say that you were stupid and immoral, and you you chose to forgive someone who raped your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
you chose
to forgive.
Ignorant.
Okay, what good is your forgiveness?
It's
worthless.
Doesn't mean anything.
Absolutely worthless.
Doesn't mean anything.
You know, last time I checked, I kind of know my, you know, they use pay grade to describe your authority within and ability within a organization.
Right.
My pay grade within the Covenant family does not qualify me to provide forgiveness.
I think what they're doing is they're trying to emulate this caricature of Yahusha.
Yes.
You know, he'd bump into a fence post and say, oh, I forgive you, old fence post, you know, type of thing. That's what they're trying to do.
And I know that you can read parts of the heavily copy-edited and triple translated, losing almost everything between the translations and the copy edits, Christian New Testament.
Quadruply translated.
Right, and you can say, you know, and forgive, forgive those who, forgive me and forgive those who sin against me. You know, us forgiving doesn't do any good. It doesn't provide forgiveness for the individual. You know, me forgiving doesn't provide salvation. It doesn't provide any remedy.
There's something that kind of bleeds through when it's saying your brothers. And I understand that. You know, some guy falls down, he makes a mistake. Maybe he says something completely stupid. You know, that happens in families.
Let's use a term other than forgive, because forgive indicated the purpose of the mitzvah is to forgive. The purpose of Yahweh's Torah is to provide the means to forgiveness for his children.
That's right.
Maybe the answer is, let's... We will, once we, and we don't even use the term overlook, because when somebody does something that's opposed to Yahweh, we don't want to overlook it. But by the same token, if they're as part of the family, you don't want to constantly berate them with it.
You want to get it aired out. Get it aired out and put it to bed
and correct it, and then you move on. You know?
Right.
My sons have both said things that were inappropriate. In every case, we've dealt with it immediately. We've talked it through. We discussed why it was inappropriate. Said, you know, we ought not do this again. And then we moved on really as if it had not happened, other than the instructive aspect of having learned and reinforced an aspect of life in a family. But do I bring it up again? No, of course not. And that's not me forgiving. It's not me overlooking. It's that I don't harass them.
Don't dwell on it.
Don't dwell on it.
You don't bring out the baseball bat.
No.
Yeah, you know, hit somebody with a... What I love is when somebody makes a mistake and they admit it to you, or they admit it to a group of people, and somebody just keeps using that like a baseball bat.
Right.
You know, everybody makes mistakes.
Right.
You know, that's one thing. But, you know, if we're all moving in the same direction, that's what counts. Now, what bothers me is when you have somebody who is genuinely interested in how that direction works, and you're sharing that direction and nature of Yahweh with them and his plan with them, and some genius Christian jumps in there. Oh, no, you got all this wrong. This guy's a legalist. I was called that today, a legalist. I actually put Yahweh's words up, and this is what they said, and I believed them, and therefore I was a legalist. And, by the way, he called the Torah law. I said, well, you sound like a Pharisee to me. That's how they viewed the Torah.
Yeah.
Are you a Pharisee?
Right. And the bottom line here is that there is no such thing as a legalist. To be Torah observant means that you are paying attention to Yahweh's guidance and his teaching, which seems like a fairly intelligent thing to do. So, you know, the response is no. Torah means instruction. It means teaching. It means guidance. And since that guidance flows from Yahweh, was inspired by him, was literally articulated by him, it seems entirely reasonable for me to follow his advice and to closely examine and carefully consider, the Hebrew term is shamar, observe, his guidance. Does that make me a legalist? Because I don't even know if there is a Hebrew word for law, and there is no Hebrew word for obey. So
I'm assuming you're listening to my teacher and taking his instructions seriously.
Since my teacher happens to be God.
Yeah. I happen to have the best teacher in the world. I think it's smart to listen to what he has to say.
I think so, too. And the benefits are you come to know him, you'll come to like him, you'll come to respect him, you'll come to understand what he's offering, and you'll respond. I mean, that's it. But before you can do any of those things, you've got to walk away from the religious corruptions. And one of the most disgusting and loathsome religious corruptions is the idea that the Torah is legalistic and that it's a bunch of laws that have to be obeyed. That is one of the most loathsome and disgusting corruptions. And anybody who advocates it is an enemy of God, an enemy of mine, and obviously a foe of Larry's.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm in that mix. Yeah, I'll own that. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, week from today on Friday, I'd like to return right to 119:158 because it properly describes the appropriate response of a father and family member to those who are adversarial to the family, to be disgusted by them and to despise them. And in this case, he defines those, Dod does, that he is disgusted by and that he loathes those who do not observe. Lo Shamar, the Imrah, Yahweh's instruction and promise. That's enough.
Yeah, he's very blunt about it. He's very clear about it. He's not running into them looking to defend them or forgive them or browbeat them into the truth somehow, kicking and screaming to into reality.
No.
You know, it's
just
I don't know how else to deal with these people.
Yeah.
I really.
The appropriate thing for you to do is to show your disgust. You know, for you to demean Yahweh's teaching as laws to be obeyed, and that somebody who observes Yahweh's teaching is demeaned as a legalist, even though there is no concept of that in the Torah. I find that disgusting that you would demean Yahweh's testimony that way. I find it repulsive that you would do so. You're a disgusting individual for even promoting the myth that Yahweh's testimony imposes a legalistic regimen. And particularly when his testimony is about him liberating us, that his testimony is about him being our father, when his testimony is about him offering to adopt us in his covenant, when his testimony is about providing invitations for us to meet with him. And you want to call that legalistic and you want to demean all of that and wipe it away because you don't like God, because you don't like what he had to say? Problem is you, pal. You don't like God. You don't like what he had to say. So you're demeaning his testimony and his Torah.
Well, they're saying they don't even like his mitzvah.
They don't like him. They don't like anything in the Torah.
Yeah, I know, but
even like the Torah's covenant. That's why they have a new one.
Yeah, that's the truth.
They don't like the Torah's covenant. They don't like the Torah's instruction. They don't like the Torah's God. They don't like any part of it.
You know, if you really talk to 90-95% of Christians, at least the ones that I'd met in my previous life, most of them just talk about being saved. They don't really talk about, you know, being empowered by a billion times and becoming a life
saved by grace. You know, those cute little nature girls, I mean, they must be really something.
I mean, they're going down to the bare minimums. I just don't want to die. I'm afraid to die. I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it.
And fear is the greatest driver, the greatest motivator of the religious is fear.
Yeah, it is fear. Yep.
You know, this is a little different subject, but we opened the show. They're talking about Janus, the god. You know, there was a King Janus.
Right.
You know, and to whom the Roman calendar was, you know, they named that month after this King Janus. And I'm looking at his seal.
Yeah.
And it was sent over to me by Lisa.
And by the way, it's two-faced.
And,
it's two-faced. The seal of Janus is actually two faces.
Yeah, that's the god. But I'm looking at the seal of this King Janus.
Uh-huh.
And guess what? It was a swastika.
Oh, wow.
A swastika.
Well, so the seal of the King Janus is a swastika. And and the seal of the pagan god Janus is being two-faced.
Yes,
if you look at it, it's a face and profile both left and right. It's two-faced. Is the
can you believe this is
someone I want to follow?
Oh gosh! Well, I mean, the whole pagan thing is just so ridiculous. Hey guys, I'm going to go take my wife to dinner, and so I'm going to bid you farewell for this evening. But I enjoyed every moment of the last hour and 45 minutes.
Oh, by the way, that was a very good find in finding Abraham's name in there. Amazing. Yeah, walk away from Babylon. Do what Abraham did.
Yeah. There's just so much great teaching that's part of this psalm. I truly love this psalm. I mean, we could it's like the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, where they paint it and then they start over again and they paint it. We could cover this for the rest of our lives and still not fully benefit from what's being conveyed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you guys have a good weekend, guys.
You too. Happy Shabbat.
Good seventh day.
Okay. Good night, guys. Bye.